Hi, I'm Sophia Casella, and this is Two with the Two, where each week I interview a new person in agriculture to educate the public about the 2% that feeds America. Today, I'm with Greg Gardner.
Thank you, Sophia. My name is Greg Gardner, and we're here at Ashland, Kansas, and at Gardner Angus Ranch. And Sophia is asked to have a little bit of history about our family. And our family originated in England when we first traced it back that far. We came to the East Coast, and the family migrated across the United States. We've actually had, as many American families have,
Members that fought on both sides of the Civil War. But my
earliest recollections of the family as they left
Missouri and were stationed or living in northeastern Kansas.
My great grandfather was the first one to come to this country in this area of
Kansas and Clark County, Kansas. And he came in 1885.
five in a group of covered wagons with five of their families.
And the reason that they came at that time period, this area of the United States was some
Some
of
of
the
the last
last
area in the continental U.S.
that was settled. And the
reason for that quick trip back through American history.
during 1849, when the gold rush was on to California,
They
everybody
got through here so they could get to the gold fields as quick as they could.
then the Civil War happened and there was a little break. But
During that time period, still the Indians of early America were
the owners and proprietors of the country.
this region that we live in right here was the last stronghold of
Quanah Parker and the Comanche Indians. And this
area was known to their people as Comancheria.
and they are an interesting
History lesson to be studied sometime, and there's an
excellent book, Empire of the Summer Moon, that tells all about the Comanche
From its earliest known history and
until present day. But they are a fascinating people.
that my admiration for them is their
Ability to master and domesticate horses. And once
they
they
rose to power with the ability to be horsemen.
where they were once a downtrodden and enslaved tribe
And people, they took no mercy on those that were
left. And in the earlier stories about the Comanche,
left. In Arizona, the early Catholic Church and the missions tried to get
the Apaches and the native people to come in and be domesticated.
and find Jesus, and they were a little reluctant to do that.
And then there's a time period in history where all of a sudden the missionaries were
Becoming flooded with people that wanted to come and know God and be
with the settlements. Unbeknownst to the missionaries and the
Catholic priests, what was happening on the southern high plains,
was a genocide of the Comanche Indian, and they were
taking names and killing anybody that was in their way. And so they took ownership
of the southern buffalo herd, and they were the lords of the plains.
in Comancheria. And from the Wind River Reservation,
In area in the mountains of Wyoming to
the Texas Plains, and all in between, they owned all of this.
and so how does this fit into our family? Well,
I forget the
exact time period, but when the U.S. Army captured Quanah Parker,
and the Indians in their winter lodge in Palo Duro Canyon down around Amarillo.
they took all the horses and they at
That
that
time, the Army and United States government had been eradicating the buffalo herds.
and so this was just the last vestige of unsettled
European white settlers in America. And so this region of
the High Plains. They opened it up with the U.S. government.
and the Homestead Act. And so the Homestead Act said if you came out
Here and settled, you could get 160 acres of free ground.
And so those were the settlers that came in that time period, and my great grandfather
And his wife, they came here in 1885 and staked their home.
Homestead quarter section. And if you stayed long enough,
You could get another quarter section. So
essentially 320 acres of free land, but the government was trying to get
people out here to populate this area of the unsettled.
High Plains. And you think about 1885, you're
9 years beyond
1876 in the Battle of Little Bighorn and Custer.
In 1881 was the gunfight at the OK Corral.
So you're still talking about a time period that this was literally unsettled.
And it was the end of what Western mythology would
call the Wild West. But it was still a frontier. And in many ways,
we still live on a frontier today. It's an
area where not only in 1885, but as we've had experiences
in the last few years, you better be
self-reliant to be able to come through some of the challenges that
nature and mankind throw at you. And so that all being said,
the reason that they stopped here
was because there was grass and water. And that's normally
why a populace will settle, if they have access to water.
Mm-hmm. Through research, I found that during that exact time
period, 1885 to 1887, Texas and the panhandle of Texas was in a huge drought,
and it actually was so desperate that they
named it. It was called the Big Dry. But if you go from this
location 60 miles to the southwest, you would have been in that
drought area. But they found water, and also
in this area, we're a very arid region, and our average
rainfall is 18 to 20 inches.
It's that high?
Yeah.
A lot lower.
You know, in
2010 and 11, we were in a severe drought and one of
the worst droughts that's been in recorded Kansas history.
This ranch in places only had 3 inches that year. This
past year, from May 25th
until September 10th, we had over 28 inches of rain. And so
it comes and goes in cycles, but I say all that about water.
When you leave,
the farther you go from this area back east,
it's worth another, every 40 miles is worth another inch of rain. And so
what is the importance of rain? Well, rain will grow trees.
And so when you go back towards Wichita and
that area of the population, there's building materials
to build houses and buildings. When you come out here, because of
prairie fires and the lack of moisture, you do not have an abundance
of lumber unless you buy it and ship it in. And so what the settlers would
do would dig a hole in the ground or a sod dugout.
And so in 1885, my great-grandparents built a
sod dugout. And in 1889, my granddad was born
in that sod dugout. And the fascinating thing to me is the
location of that area is still just about 2 miles from where we sit here today.
Really?
So this fat branch of the family hasn't moved very far
since that time period. But to speed up a little,
as we go forward, after they were there for
a while, they either starved out or whatever, but they left that area.
And then a few years later, they came back. That time, they shipped their
belongings to Dodge City on the railroad. They picked
them up and then wagoned them down to the Clark County and settled in a
place north of town. And so over the years,
as my granddad became a child and grew
into adulthood, he had an interesting life. But
if you think back, you know, being born in
the 1800s, and it fascinates me that here we
are in 2024, and I can literally say that I
touched someone that lived in the 1800s as my granddad.
But he was very
fascinated by agriculture. He enjoyed working with the
horses, and they did a lot of horse-powered farming at that time period.
And it wasn't mechanized. And then as he
grew to adult, he
got married late in life, and he married my grandmother, who was a one-room school
teacher here in Clark County. And her side of the story is
another fascinating thing that we'll leave there. But
so he got married when he was 42 years old, and so my dad
was born in 1931. But the significance of what I'm about to elaborate on that, they lived through the Dust Bowl there in dirty 30s. And
it was in a time period where, not unlike
a lot of other things and challenges of nature, you literally
either you lived or you died. And it wasn't for the weak of heart.
Many of the early diaries of families that moved to
this area, one of the things that is a constant for
those of us that are natives is the wind. And so
there are literally families that wrote, many of them,
the wives that kept the diaries.
The wind drove them insane.
Oh, it drives my family insane.
And they left this area
to go back to Indiana or Ohio, wherever they came from.
But even present day, with a lot of
people trying to migrate to the rural areas,
Kansas, because I mean, Kansas is in the high plains
in a prairie, open prairie state.
But you have to have a love for the prairie. We
see it as a beautiful landscape, but if you're looking for a Yellowstone
atmosphere of Montana, it's not going to meet your demands.
The environment can be very harsh. We've just come out of 2 weeks
ago, 20 below wind chill factor temperatures.
And we will go into time periods in the summer where
it's not out of the question to be air temperature 110, mm-hmm.
25 mile an hour winds. So it's a blast furnace.
So we live on both ends of the spectrum, but the good thing is in the wintertime,
it won't stay cold a long time. It may be cold for 10 days,
a week, but it'll break and get back up above freezing. And so
you learn to live with it and
move with the rhythms of the weather. But
that all being said, the people that have stayed in this country
have stayed with determination.
And as you well know, and we can talk about that
later too, but not only did they have to go through those hardships and coming out of the dirty 30s,
the things that we've experienced since that time period,
it's not for the faint of heart. And so I just put that
up to say and mention it because they were tough people,
but the environment shaped them. And it
shaped them also for the future and how they would operate and raise their
families and go forward. And so I think that's one of the things that's
fascinating about agriculture in general. Most
agriculture people that stick with it and have legacy
families with children that come back home, the
children have learned how to work, and they've learned how to work from their parents who've learned how to work from their parents.
And that's one of the things that will
elevate these people as they go forward. A lot of times
some of the interns that we'll have will ask, what do you
suggest I do going forward, or
what advice can you give me? We had a set of
interns leave the other day, and young lady asked me this, and I said,
you don't know it, but you're already so far ahead because you know how to work.
And if you know how to work in today's world,
as you've already said, it's actually less than 2%.
But you stated 2%, which is a round number.
Yeah.
2% of the population
is feeding 98% of the rest of the, and
actually it's globally.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, that
already gives you a step up and an advantage over your peers in any
field of endeavors that you go forward in. And so agriculture
is our great ace in the hole in many ways. But
getting back on track to our family,
I have to check. I know my phone is not the most reliable. Okay, we're still good.
And if we need to rig up
a charger, battery, or something, extension cord.
Thank you.
I'm telling you this, you're already getting a sense, but it can go for a
while if you want it to. We're only in the 1800s or 1930s.
Okay, so let's jump a little forward to, because your dad took over the farm in 18.
He was born in 1931.
And he grew up here, and obviously at the end of the 30s,
and he can remember the day Pearl Harbor was bombed.
If you do a search for during
the Dust Bowl days mm-hmm. of Black Sunday, he lived through Black Sunday.
What's Black Sunday?
Well, Black Sunday was a time period in the 30s
that the wind started blowing. And
if you go back, and I only
make this more detailed because
my generation and age group
understand what we're talking about. There's a lot in your program
that don't.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of this is not taught anymore. But
in the
19-teens
okay.
and World War One, we sent
all our troops to the First World War in Europe. One of the things we had to figure out
was how to feed them.
Mm.
And this portion of Kansas at that time period during the 20s, think about in relationship with what we've just been talking about. The buffalo herds have been eradicated. People have moved in here to settle. But they are just starting to get farming techniques.
And you think back, well, what did they know about farming? Well, they only
knew from where they came from. So whether that's Ohio or
Indiana. But many of those people, unbeknownst to them, they
came here and turned the prairie sod over and bared all
these grasses down to the soil. And so with the plows
and instruments that they had to it, it worked in
Ohio with rich, black, fertile soil. The government
has raided this land. It's a
very sandy loam country. And so the nickname for it,
or the definition of it, is highly erodible land.
We nickname it hell. But if you bare the
grasses, it's just sugar sand and blow sand underneath. Mm-hmm. And so
during the 20s, it rained in Kansas.
And so the farmers from fence row to fence row plowed up the prairie
and planted wheat. And they got good prices for their crops.
And that went to feed the war effort. Well, it quit raining
in the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
And for 10 years, the dust just blew.
So Black Sunday was a day that it was even
worse than ever. And so as the dark cloud,
if you've seen any pictures of
the cloud of the Starbuck fire coming towards Ashland, Kansas, mm-hmm.
you can equate that to Black Sunday.
Ooh.
And the interesting thing in the comparison between the Starbuck fire and Black Sunday,
we that know about
Black Sunday somewhat laughed about Black Monday
of March 6, 2017. But in one of the history books,
they have talked about children at the time period
of Black Sunday asking their parents, is this the end of the world?
You know, they have relatively little communication with the outside world, but this black cloud that's rolling over the top of them and swallowing them, and ultimately that cloud went all the way to the East Coast in Washington, D.C.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of the government people going like, what is going
on out there? Well, as Ashland was being evacuated during the fire,
there is a reported report in
one of the people's stories, and afterwards
one of their grandchildren asked them as they were leaving and evacuating Ashland,
is this the end of the world? And so
I find it interesting during those two scenarios that the young
people would think of it like that, but it could be the end of times.
But that all being said, going forward,
Dad lived through there, and like I said, he was alive and
could tell us he remembered when Pearl Harbor was
bombed. And so, but he was born in
1931, and he went to school at Ashland. But once he graduated from Ashland,
he went to school at Kansas State to further his education. That's where he
learned how to AI or artificially inseminate cows. And so as
he came back home, my granddad
had, during the Dirty 30s and the Depression era,
had actually raised a lot of sheep to make it through. And at
one time, they had 3,000 ewes that they lambed out and took care of. And then as they came, as Dad came home, they had some commercial cattle. They had some, I forget which different breeds, but ultimately, looking at it from this point in time, a lot of people ask the question, how did we get involved with Angus cattle? And did you know all these things that Angus is famous for right now? And it's like, no. And at that time period in life, Hereford cattle were the king of the High Plains. And Angus cattle were something different. And I didn't get to know my granddad very much, but people have told us that he was quite the contrarian. He just wanted to be different, so I want those different cattle. And so fast forward, he and my dad and granddad bought a dispersal herd of Angus cows that were registered. They didn't want the paperwork on them and just started from that point on the commercial side of it. And so as Dad became more involved, there's kind of two different facets in the cattle world. There is a side of the cattle industry that is a show side of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they exhibit a lot of cattle, and
it has its merits, and it's good for teaching
a lot
youngins
of work ethic. And then there's another side of it that is
not to say that the other side isn't a business, because there's
a way to make money in that side.
Mm-hmm.
But
the general connotation would be what we're involved is the performance
seed stock end of it.
We're involved now in the what would be genetics.
And that's what we actually sell is genetics. But my dad actually had a show steer that was quite successful for a time that he showed on the show circuit. And he won the American Roll, and he won Denver, and he came and won the Kansas State Fair. And part of the championship proceeds of the Kansas State Fair was a $100 credit in the registered heifer sale there. So he bought a couple registered heifers, and that was his first foray into the registered side of it. And so
Dad
got his education,
came home from K-State. He wanted to
artificially inseminate or breed cows.
And at that time period, and probably still to a day to a certain extent,
you would think
a bull that has had the expense where his semen's been collected, and he must be something
above average and better than the common animal.
And so if his AI bull and semen is available, he must be a good one.
And so I say that not to
belittle anything, but you can collect semen on any bull.
Mm-hmm.
and so there needs to be more quantitative requirements. But the thing that makes our story going forward so fascinating to me,
in 1964, he made the commitment on this ranch,
which was pretty radical at the time and still is radical thinking throughout the industry.
But the only way he would reproduce his cattle was
to artificially inseminate every one. And he was trying
to add as much value as he could, and we are still doing that to this day.
But so it set up a controlled experiment.
And so you fast forward from 1964 to 1980.
Mm-hmm. 1980 was a very important crossroads of the industry and the breed,
because it was the first sire summary that ever came out.
And the sire summary would take all the highly used bulls that were documented, AI sires, and they were put into
a
book and a printout. And at this time period,
we also, from the vantage point of experience,
many people know the terminology
about EPDs or expected progeny differences. That's just common
nomenclature in agriculture. There was a time
period where that wasn't known. What's an EPD?
What's expected progeny differences? And so in 1980,
all the traits that were measurable and could be quantified
through expected progeny differences, those bulls
could be charted, and you could see the genetic differences if you breed to this bull versus this bull through his EPDs. And so Dad was so excited because 24 of the bulls that he'd used in that time period were going to be in the printout. He was going to see how much progress he'd made. Well, he averaged up all the EPDs on those 24 bulls, and we are a different program than the vast majority of breeding programs in the fact that the largest portion of our cow herd calves in the fall. Most people in Kansas or the High Plains will have spring calving. But the reason that we do it is because we have access to wheat pasture, and we circle back around to what we once thought was a bad thing in the highly erodible soil that we have. It is also a very positive if managed right, because that type of soil, we can graze wheat pasture cattle. When you get farther north or to the east of us in the tighter clay soils, if you put cattle out there when it's wet, they're just going to destroy the crop. You know, we can have an inch of rain, it sucks up in the soil, and cattle are still grazing. So with that ability to do that and manage properly with wheat pasture in the winter, spring grasses, and then whether we have sorghum sedan or something else, but we can be on some sort of green feed if it rains year round. And so that's why we have a fall breeding program. Also, when our calves traditionally being born in the fall, they're 6 months earlier than the spring crop. And so when we sell these calves as quote unquote yearlings, they're actually 18 months of age. And so they're more developed, they can handle more cattle, and less breakdowns and problems. So that's an advantage that worked into it. But when you go and start a new index numerically, the average will be 0, 0, 0. You know, nowadays, since 1980, what's average is a different point. It's floating. But that all being said, for 1980, when he averaged up all the economical traits on those 24 sires, and I need to back up one more time. At that time period, he was weaning off. I mean, that's how you make your living, was selling feeder calves. But we were weaning off. We would wean because of our wheat pasture and our grasses at 10 months of age. Most people will wean on spring calves 6 months of age. They don't have access to the feed sources. So, but the cows are bred, they're out on wheat pasture, the calves are supposedly gaining. But in today's program, we get our most cheapest cost of gains while those calves are nursing their mothers. The mothers are pregnant. What else have they got to do? You know, and we'll wean them at 9 to 10 months of age, freshen up the cows, and then they'll start calving 30 days, 60 days later. But that all being said, he was only weighing off a finished calf at 523 pounds, which if you were early weaning spring calves or something, that might be good. Fine. But if you're looking at having a family's coming to return to the operation, that's not going to pay the bills. And so he also knew that when he got the information on those 24 bulls, since 64 to 80, he'd made no progress. He changed nothing. He was 0, 0, 0, 0. And so he knew that he still needed more pounds, he needed more growth. And so the first year in 1981 that we weaned off those calves, but they were of known sires and the and progeny proven bulls, which they had by progeny proven, you prove them by that sire's calves and how those calves are measured in what they do. And so the sire gets credit for it. How much, you know, what the birth weight scores are, the weaning weight, the 205, the yearling, and kill data in the carcass end of it. We often laugh where we think in 1981 it maybe rained that spring and we shouldn't have got this big a jump. But the first year of those calves by those proven bulls, they weaned off in the same forage system, same management, and everything was the same except the genetics. They weaned off at 661 pounds. And so he knew right then and there that EPDs work.
And so going forward in our program, at that time period, genetic-wise, as a breed, we didn't have the tools genetically to do what we're doing today. You had to find animals that were specialists.
You had to have a light birth weight bull to breed your heifers. You had to have a high growth bull to breed your cows. You had to have a high marbling bull if you were going to get carcass data. And so over the years since that time period, with our focus on multi-trait selection going forward to the animals that we have today that we sell,
today we have genetic, for just to
be candid, genetic freaks of the industry that can do everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have it all in one genetic package.
You can have a bull that is a light birth weight heifer bull. As he gets older,
he can be moved to the cows, and you don't lose any genetic advantage breeding
to the cows because his explosive growth, once those calves are born
to a year of age, they will be competitive
with all the growth sires. One of the things that we have to do and monitor
in our program, in our selection pressures,
is one of the things, if you don't put a govern on
the end, which is yearling weight, you want them
to grow to a year of age as explosively and quickly as you can,
but then you want them to stop. You have sire groups
inside the breed that have extended growth patterns, larger frame cattle
that cost more to maintain during the winter.
And a lot of our customer base, which we're very blessed and fortunate
that we have a national and somewhat international base, but
a lot of our customers in the Southwest can't afford
the frame size cow that someone in
Ohio and the